Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Welcome to Cineversary, a podcast that celebrates a milestone anniversary of a masterful work of cinema. Each month we send happy birthday wishes to a different film currently observing a joyous jubilee. That's everything from a 20th to a 100th anniversary. I'm your host, Eric Martin, creator and moderator of the Cineverse Film Discussion Group that meets weekly in the Chicagoland area. Well, we're on an octogenarian celebration kick of sorts because, like last month, we'll be honoring another film that has an 80th birthday. One of the most controversial movies of Hollywood's golden age and also one of the most important and socially relevant. It's The Grapes of Wrath, directed by John Ford. Joining us for this installment is my friend Joseph McBride, film historian, biographer, author, educator, and screenwriter, who's written two books on Ford. He's personally interviewed the late director and even provided the commentary track for the DVD and Blu-ray of The Grapes of Wrath. Joe and I will climb aboard the Joe Jalopy and travel across Route 66 and Hollywood in our exploration of this picture as we make a case for why this film is worth celebrating all these years later, its cultural impact and legacy, what we can learn from the picture today, how it stood the test of time, and more. But it's constructive first to share with you some background on this month's movie, courtesy of Wikipedia. The Grapes of Wrath is a 1940 American drama film directed by John Ford. It was based on John Steinbeck's 1939 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. The screenplay was written by Nunnally Johnson, and the executive producer was Daryl F. Zanuck. The film tells the story of the Jodes, an Oklahoma family who, after losing their farm during the Great Depression of the 1930s, become migrant workers and end up in California. The motion picture details their arduous journey across the United States as they travel to California in search of work and opportunities for the family members, and features cinematography by the great Greg Toland. The Grapes of Wrath made its theatrical debut on January 24, 1940. Its original budget is estimated at $750,000. The film is widely considered to be one of the greatest American films of all time. In 1989, it was one of the first 25 films to be selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Now today, the movie earns an impressive 100% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, where its average critical score is 8.98 out of 10. Let's take a listen now to the movie's original trailer.
Sweeping across the country comes one of the great literary achievements of our time. A human, revealing, soul-stirring story that instantly becomes the most discussed novel of modern literature. The Grapes of Wrath.
The Grapes of Wrath, please.
I'll have to put you on the waiting list. We've never had such a demand for a book. Do you have a copy of Grapes of Wrath?
Sorry, we're all sold out.
Yes, The Grapes of Wrath. Well, send me as many copies as you can. I can't supply the demand.
The Grapes of Wrath.
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 As sales skyrocket, The Grapes of Wrath becomes the book of the nation. Everyone, everywhere, joins in the discussion of its vital problems. Due to this unprecedented popularity, producers vie for the motion picture rights. And finally, 20th Century Fox announces the purchase of the book and plans for its immediate production. A storm of discussion arouses the nation. Speculation and rumor are rife to the effect that no producer will venture to film this great dramatic masterpiece of human hearts. Daryl F. Zanuck, production head of 20th Century Fox Studios, emphatically announces that The Grapes of Wrath will be made. All of the resources of this vast studio are marshaled for the production. John Ford, Academy Award winner, is given the directorial assignment. The cast is carefully chosen to make John Steinbeck's unforgettable characters come to life. Tom Joad is played by Henry Fonda. Maud Joad is played by Jane Darwell. Casey is played by John Carradine. Grandpa is played by Charlie Grapewin. Rosa Sharon is played by Doris Bowden. Paul Joad is played by Russell Simpson. Al is played by O.Z. Whitehead. Muley is played by John Quaylen. Connie is played by Eddie Quillen. And now, at last, The Grapes of Wrath is ready for the screen as the motion picture captures all the drama, suspense, action, tears and laughter of the story that stirred a nation.
Okay, put the brakes on the car, Tom. If you've not already seen The Grapes of Wrath, this is fair warning that, yes, spoilers are ahead. But now's a great chance to pause the podcast and fulfill your film fan duty and obligation as a lover of great literature by watching The Grapes of Wrath already. All right, everybody now up to speed? Great. It's time now to roll my interview with John Ford and Grapes of Wrath expert Joseph McBride. Welcome, Joe. It's a pleasure to have you back on Cineversary. You joined us just a few months ago for Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and proved to be the perfect guest for that installment. And I'm just so pleased that you said yes to Grapes of Wrath.
Thank you very much. It's a great film. I'm honored to talk about it.
When and where did you first see The Grapes of Wrath? Can you recall?
Well, I saw it at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I went to school in the late 60s. And that's where I became a film buff. I was watching a lot of films as a youth, but I hadn't seen many Ford films, but I saw The Grapes of Wrath early in my time there. They had a little festival of John Ford films, and I was very impressed, and so I've seen it countless times over the years, and I did an audio commentary for Fox in 2004 with Steinbeck scholar Susan Schillinglaw, who I invited to join me in. So it's a film that means a lot to me. It's one of Ford's great films.
For my take, I don't believe I saw The Grapes of Wrath until it came out on DVD, maybe about 20 years ago or so. I do remember being blown away by the cinematography and lighting in particular. I mean, this is Greg Toland a year before Citizen Kane, right? So just amazing lighting and camera work, as well as many of the performances. I mean, of course, Henry Fonda, Jane Darwell, but especially some of those character actors. John Quaylen just bowled me over. I'd like to talk more about that cast in just a bit.
Yeah, Toland's photography is miraculous. Ford said it was great photography. He said there was nothing beautiful to shoot. It was shot, it looks kind of like a documentary, which is part of its strength. Although it's also very, you know, if you're into cinematography, you can study the use of light and shadow is very striking. Ford at his best combined those two modes. Ford's films are documentary visions of an ideal world. There's a kind of a tension. What he sets up is a beautiful composition or a strong composition, if it's not pictorially beautiful, but it's effective dramatically. And then he makes it spontaneous within the shot. He didn't like to do a lot of takes, and so he liked the spontaneity of actors being a little unfamiliar with the scene, not overly rehearsed.
I'd love to talk more about Ford as the right director for this film in just a bit. But first, Joe, why is The Grapes of Wrath worth celebrating 80 years later? Why does it still matter? And how do you think it stood the test of time?
Well, I was struck watching it again last night that, you know, it's very timely. Wow. I mean, you know, because we're immersed in this whole argument about immigration and the world crisis about refugees, which is one of the major issues around the world, is a lot of refugees again.
Yeah.
And how people welcome them or not welcome them. There's a lot of xenophobia in the world. And so it's very timely because it's about internal immigration. It's Americans moving from one part of America to another. The Okies from Oklahoma is what they called them, who were dispossessed and their land became barren. It was not well used, and then they had the Dust Bowl in the 30s and the Depression, and people lost their homes, and they got on the road and went to California.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a form of immigration, but they were received in a very hostile way. At the California line, there was a lot of oppression and intimidation, and mobs of organized thugs hired by the farm growers. When they got to California, they were exploited and put in miserable camps and made to work as fruit pickers. A lot of them were cotton farmers back in Oklahoma, and the cotton crop kind of died. In the 20s, the average pay for a farm worker was 30 cents an hour, and they cut it down to 25 cents an hour in around the time of The Grapes of Wrath, which is the late 30s, which is when Steinbeck investigated the issues and wrote his book, which came out in 1939.
Okay.
But he started researching the farm workers' plight in 1936, and he wrote a series of newspaper articles first for a San Francisco paper, and it was collected as a book called The Harvest Gypsies, which is worth reading. It's kind of the raw material for The Grapes of Wrath. And he had also written other works about strikes. And so it was a very hot issue at the time, but it's very, very timely now, and all the issues are things we care about now.
Of course, we survived the Great Recession just a few years back as well, and The Grapes of Wrath came up in the context of that during that terrible time, and it just goes to show that this film can come back into resonance and importance for different generations, different time periods, right?
Yeah, and it's a timeless film in that it's a great work of art, and it captures a moment in time. It's one of the best films about the Depression, and Hollywood didn't make a lot of gritty films about the Depression. There were a few Wild Boys of the Road and Mr. Deeds Goes to Town and Our Daily Bread, but, you know, they tended to make escapist films in the 30s. So The Grapes of Wrath stands out. It was a very radical film for 1939. It came out in 1940, and for Fox to make it was unusual, and it was a very gutsy film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it told the truth, and it didn't pull hardly any punches, and so it stood out, and it attracted controversy. The book was very controversial. It was burned in some California cities.
Interesting.
It was banned in many libraries, and actually it's still banned in libraries today. It's one of those books like To Kill a Mockingbird or Catcher in the Rye that keeps getting banned because it's still considered inflammatory, you know, and because it deals with poor people, and you don't see that as much in American films, dealing with poor people in their daily struggles. It's very honest and raw looking.
Yeah, all good thoughts. If you ask me, in terms of what makes this a timeless movie, why does it still matter? How has it stood the test of time? This is what I would tell you. Ford had a knack for spotlighting American values, for themes of family and inspirational messages of the underdog, the common man, in many of his films. And this movie is no exception. He documented the westward migration of America's settlers in so many westerns, right? So it's fitting that he was the one to helm this film, which kind of plays mm-hmm. like a sad end of the dream of that westward migration that had begun generations earlier. He could also gather and direct an ensemble cast of numerous character actors, like we were talking about, like few other filmmakers could. The Ford stock company at work here has rarely been better, in my opinion. John Quaylen, Charlie Grapewin, John Carradine, Jane Darwell, Russell Simpson. You even have Ward Bond in this tiny little role. It just goes on and on, so the cast is amazing to me. It's also such a visually interesting picture, as we kind of set precedent for earlier talking about Tolan. Many scenes, you know, you look at them, they're shot outdoors on location. It gives kind of a gritty, realistic documentary-like feel. And they're shot in accurate settings, like Oklahoma's Dust Bowl and the route they take along 66, for example. But then some scenes strangely appear filmed on sets or stages with an easily spotted cyclorama, kind of blending like a nightmare fantasy with reality. There are also a lot of impressive night scenes and shots lit with very low light, just like a simple candlelight in a barn that are, to me, just totally unforgettable.
That was a really striking scene when Tom goes back to his home, which is deserted, and the family's gone. He comes out of prison, and he expects to find his family there, and they're gone. But they discover Muley, who's this dispossessed farmer, played by John Quaylen.
Incredible scene.
He's kind of hiding in the darkness. And Tolan, very daringly for Hollywood, lights it with almost no light. And as you say, it appears to be lit mainly with a candle. And obviously they had an electric light in the candle.
Yeah, amazing.
And there is a lot of outdoor stuff that looks like documentaries. And they studied the photographs of Dorothea Lange and Walker Evans and Ben Shun and people like that. Of the Depression, and films of Pere Lawrence and other documentary filmmakers, and they learned from them. But there are scenes shot in the studio, and that may seem a little odd to people today. That was common back then. Part of it is Grapes of Wrath was a relatively inexpensive film. It was $750,000, which is about what Kane cost, and it was a modestly budgeted film for its time because it was a risky venture. Gone with the Wind cost $4 million for comparison. But Ford often used interior sets, and there's an expressionist streak in John Ford that he liked to control the lighting, and he liked to when he had expressionist scenes, kind of visually stylized scenes, sometimes shot against backdrops and things, that it helps you to get into the interior of the characters. That's what expressionism is all about. So he liked to blend those things into a seamless whole, and Tolan does a good job of integrating it.
No question about it. My final thought about resonance of the movie is, as you already said, it's probably the most important, realistic, and honest Hollywood film about the Great Depression and its effect on many overlooked Americans. And for this reason alone, to me, it's an invaluable work of art. It serves as a crucial reminder to future generations about how difficult that time period was. This film has an undeniable power to evoke palpable fear in the viewer.
It's a time capsule, and you know the effects of the Depression were still going on very strongly in 39. So it captures that feeling very, very strongly, and it shows the economic exploitation by the owners. And it's remarkable that Fox made that film. Daryl Zanuck, the head of production at Fox, who Ford respected and admired a lot, was a Republican.
Is that right?
And he was known as an anti-labor guy because when the guilds were being organized in 1933 after the studios tried to cut the pay of the workers by 50%, that galvanized the directors and the actors into forming guilds, and then the writers came along. And Ford was involved in that labor movement. So Ford was in his most leftist period. He was a very complex man politically, and he evolved a lot. And you know, he's hard to pin down politically, and I do that in my book, Searching for John Ford. But I often realized that part of the key to Ford was he was inconsistent. He was he had different sides to him that were in conflict, and that's one reason he's a great artist. He could see people's viewpoints from all sides, but it makes his films sometimes contradictory or even incoherent occasionally. But you know, some films will seem more radical, and others will seem reactionary. Ford had contributed to the farm workers, and that was a big cause in Hollywood. But he said he felt very strongly about them because he identified with them because of his Irish background.
Hmm.
He said The Grapes of Wrath, the novel by Steinbeck, reminded him of the famine in Ireland when people were thrown off the land. And in the 1840s, Ford said that he really felt that the Okies were like the Irish people who had to abandon their homes or were kicked out of their homes and went out on the roads and tried to find a new life. Ford always felt very strongly his Irish heritage, and he felt part of the diaspora, and he felt like an outsider to some extent in America who had been expelled from Ireland, and he even tried to claim he was born in Ireland, which he wasn't, but he was proud of his background.
Well, I appreciate you finding that quote and providing more context there. Fascinating stuff. But Joe, in what ways do you think The Grapes of Wrath was influential on cinema and popular culture or set trends in any way?
Well, you know, it's one of those films that, you know, hasn't been copied or imitated a lot, unfortunately. You know, even today, I mean, it's worse today than it was in the studio days. They don't make very many films about social issues in Hollywood. I mean, Grapes of Wrath was a very controversial issue, and it took guts for Zanuck to make the film. And I was going to mention that since he was a Republican and he was not a big fan of organized labor, it's somewhat surprising he okayed the film, but he was a fair man. Ford respected him. He was a good filmmaker.
Yeah.
He saw that it was a good story, but Fox was controlled by the Chase Manhattan Bank.
Yeah, that's right.
It was called the Chase National Bank at the time. And Steinbeck said he wouldn't have sold the book to Fox if he had known that. But the irony was that the bank was controlled by Winthrop Aldridge, and Zanuck was summoned to New York by Aldridge, and he thought, okay, this project's going to be canceled. But Aldrich surprised him by saying his wife, Winnie, had loved the book and got him to read it. And he said, I'm really liking this book. Go ahead and make it.
Oh, funny.
To me, that shows the resilience of the capitalist system, in a sense that here's this ultimate capitalist institution making this really radical film. And it's a radical film for 1939.
Uh-huh.
And it pulls a few punches. There are calls for revolution in the novel that are eliminated. Characters talk about the need for revolution, and but it's implicit a lot in the dialogue and scenes, and Tom Joad is a rebel. And Woody Guthrie and Bruce Springsteen have both written famous songs about Tom Joad as a radical hero. He becomes radicalized. He doesn't have political views at first. He's an ex-con, but he gets really angry and starts rebelling and winds up going off to help the people, whatever he can do. And that's the trajectory of the film. But in the novel, they stay in some camps to work, and they go to a government camp, which is pretty good. It was a New Deal camp. They're treated with dignity, and you know they like it, and they do some work, and everything is going well. Then they wind up at a very bad camp in the book, And the book has a very bleak ending where they're poverty-stricken and their car doesn't work and they're trapped in a farmhouse.
And the baby's stillborn and Rosa Sharon has to give her breast to a starving man. I mean, it's bleak stuff.
They couldn't film that just because of censorship, but it's also bleak and Hollywood tends to want a happy ending. So what they did was they reversed the order of the camps so that they go from the bad camp to the government camp. So that gives a sense of hope toward the end. And the guy who runs the camp is this man who looks a lot like Franklin D. Roosevelt.
FDR, right.
Grant Mitchell. It's quite obvious that they cast him for that. But it's a sign of the New Deal taking control and ameliorating the situation, gives some hope. And then the ending of the film is the famous ending where Ma Jode and her family are in the truck and she gives this beautiful soliloquy about we're the people that live and they can't stop us because we're the people. And Ford didn't shoot that. Zanuck shot that.
That's right.
Ford wanted to end the film with Tom leaving his mother to go off. And the last shot, it's in the film where he's walking up a hill at sunrise. And it's uncertain, but it's heroic. You know, he's going to do something. We don't know what. But Zanuck wanted a more upbeat ending. So he told Ford, he called him on his ship-to-shore phone on Ford's yacht after Ford had turned in the film for editing, and said, I want to shoot this ending. And Ford said, okay. And I found in the script that Ford shot, there is an appendix where that alternate ending is in the appendix, so it had been considered. And Ford told Zanuck to direct that scene himself, and he did a good job directing it. And it's there's a bleak aspect because you don't know where they're going to wind up, and the father's face, Russell Simpson, looks very bleak, and he's...
Yeah, and he's resigned himself to relinquishing control of the family.
Yeah, part of the theme, and this happens to immigrants in general, is that the man who is the head of the family in traditional societies loses his power because of the way immigrants are treated, and so the father feels sort of helpless, and the mother is the strong matriarch, and it becomes a matriarchal society in the film. That's a very strong element, and I love that, the relationship between Tom and his mother.
Me too.
Some people consider it sentimental. Orson Welles, who was a huge fan of John Ford, said, Ford made that into a story about mother love. Sentiment is Jack's vice. When he escapes it, you get a perfect kind of innocence. Well, I disagree with him. I think that the relationship is powerful. It's more of a focus of the film than the book, which has more focus on some of the other characters.
Yeah, but a counterpoint to that is a major theme of the book is trying to keep the family together, as Ma so passionately soliloquies about. And if you don't have a really strong central relationship between Tom and his mother, who's it going to be between? Without some sentimentality, you really don't have an anchor of feeling and sentiment there that draws in the viewer to the story, in my opinion. I agree with you.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that there's a difference between sentiment and sentimentality. There's honest sentiment and then there's false sentimentality. And I think it's honest sentiment. And I do think Jane Darwell gives a fine performance. She got the Academy Award and she's very strong. And there are a few moments where she kind of overdoes it, but I think she's awfully fine. And Henry Fonda gives the performance of his lifetime. I mean, he had to sell his soul to Fox to play that part. He had to sign a 7-year contract, which he really hated.
Mm.
And then he had to do a lot of crummy films as a result. But he had done for Ford Young Mr. Lincoln and Drums Along the Mohawk right before that. It was he had become Ford's favorite actor for a while. And he's just magnificent in the part.
Hear.
And he has a great anger. And he's, as Thomas Flanagan writes, the deserted home bears an uncanny resemblance to folk memories of the abandoned famine villages of Connaught and Munster. Tom is like the Irish rebel son of such memories, sweet-natured but quick-tempered and capable of murderous rage. And as the Jode family splinters, the patriarch senile and the father helpless, it is the mother, massive and nurturing, who becomes the source of strength. The Jodes, descendants of Ford's cow-punching plainsmen, are the ethnic opposites of the Irish, but the myths echo against each other. And he says the truck, overloaded, creaking its way to California, resonates against memories of the Irish coffin ships headed across the Atlantic. In this film, Ford's thematic material, Ireland and the West, touch each other. I was in a documentary called Becoming John Ford, which is about his work at Fox.
I saw it. It's great.
Thank you. We had Peter Fonda in there, and he said it's really a modern Western, and that's a good way to look at it. You know, it's like a wagon train. You know, the shots of the trucks headed west are like wagons, like in Ford's Wagon Master and other films that he did.
Is this the closest a mainstream Hollywood movie ever came up to that time to advocating socialism? And can you think of any films that would have been inspired by The Grapes of Wrath immediately in its wake, like within the first few years? Like if it weren't for The Grapes of Wrath, we wouldn't have these films, for example.
Well, I'm not thinking exactly. I mean, there's so many precedents for films. There were a lot of socially conscious films made in the silent period, for example. And there was Wellman's Wild Boys of the Road in 1933, which is a very gritty film about kids traveling the rails. You know, I mean, it's a really tough film.
Uh-huh.
And he made Heroes for Sale in 1933, which is about dispossessed veterans of the World War One. And so there are some strong American films. Our Daily Bread by King Vidor is about a collective. It's kind of a Marxist almost film about people working together. But I don't think there have been a lot of films in the vein of The Grapes of Wrath since then. Something about Ford, though, one reason he likes this film is his films usually are about the breakup of a community and a family. And How Green Was My Valley, which he made after that, is very similar thematically in a sense. It's about a Welsh farming village, or a mining village.
That's right.
And they're in the process of breaking up. And it's similar in the sense because the village gets polluted by the mine and there's economic exploitation and the family has to break up and go to different parts of the world. And Ford loved the family and home and community. Those were his highest values. But perversely, he dwells on their destruction. That's his basic theme.
Yeah, interesting.
And he's an idealist who dwells on the destruction of his own ideals. So Ford dealt with that kind of theme many times in his films, but in different veins. You know, he didn't return to that world again exactly.
I'm always fascinated by the 2 to 3 year run of masterpieces that Ford is able to churn out between, what, 39 and 41 before he goes off to war. Stagecoach, Young Mr. Lincoln, Drums Along the Mohawk, The Grapes of Wrath, The Long Voyage Home, Tobacco Road, and How Green Was My Valley, all back to back to back to back to back to back, right?
Yeah, he was on a roll, and I say in my biography, Searching for John Ford, it's a bit of a oversimplification. 1939 was the year that John Ford discovered America. He made that great trilogy, Stagecoach, Young Mr. Lincoln, Drums Along the Mohawk, and in the same year he shot The Grapes of Wrath, although he shot Stagecoach the year before. But he was fully aware the war was coming. He was a member of the Naval Reserve since 1934, and he was working for Naval Intelligence, and he was sure the war was coming to America. And the war broke out in 39 in Europe, and Ford started the field photographic branch of Hollywood technicians. He trained them for war, and then when the war came, he incorporated them into the OSS and spent 4 years covering the war. So he was, I think, trying to alert the country to the values of our country, you know, by making these three films about pioneers and then making a modern film about modern problems, but they're pioneers in a sense. And as I say, they're like immigrants, even though they're within our country. It's an immigrant saga, and Ford dealt with that partly because he was the son of immigrants. And then he makes The Great Grapes of Wrath, and I think that he designed that very deliberately as his final film in case he didn't come back from the war, which there was a very good chance he wouldn't. You know, it ends in the afterlife, even, and it's a profound film that he often said was his favorite.
Remarkable. I never thought about it that way. I'm going to have to go back, watch that film, and ponder on what you just said.
Yeah, it's about the family breaking up, the whole community breaking up. There's a very moving scene where the son, youngest son, shows a map of the world, and he points out to his parents where all the different children have gone to, and they're, you know, they've scattered throughout the world, and it's the ultimate breakup of a family. But it's a really dark and tragic film. It's a heartwarming film, but I find it really painful because the young boy has a chance to escape the life of being a coal miner, and he decides to go down in the mines like his father. And but it starts with him leaving home too as an older man. But it ends with Ford brings back all the characters in a sort of stylized life after death. It's almost like, okay, here's my final statement on life. And fortunately, Ford came back.
I want to ask you about the moral to the story of The Grapes of Wrath. What messages or themes stand out to you?
Well, part of it is holding the family together as much as you can, although it doesn't totally work because Some of the members drift off, and then Tom has to leave because he's an outlaw. Mm-hmm. Ford dealt with what I call the noble outlaw in a lot of his films, a person who's officially an outlaw, but he works for society in ways that society cannot see, and that's Tom. And the mother is a conservative force in the sense that she's trying to hold the family together, but she's also very aware that it's inevitable that Tom will have to leave and family will break up, and that's why it's so sad at the end. But it's also about the scattering of traditional culture and family into a new unknown world, which is part of Ford's great theme. And it's a melancholy theme. It's not a happy film, you know.
Some themes that stand out to me include, of course, economic inequality, social injustice, the empty promise of the American dream. You got these well-run machines we see, the Caterpillars. They have the power. The Joads are just trying to keep their broken-down machine of an automobile running to regain power and autonomy in their own small way. But you've got the resiliency of the human spirit, the survival of dignity in the face of adversity. These are important messages, right? The individual may fail, but a unified community will prevail, I think is another thing.
Big theme of the film is the integration of the hero into the community. Tom is a loner at first. It starts with the kind of classic Western film shot of a lone man walking down a road at dawn. It's a beautiful shot. And then he's a rebel, he's a loner, but he gets integrated into a social rebellion through Preacher Casey, who's a radical. And so it's kind of about the growth of somebody realizing that, you know, one person can't do it alone, you have to join forces. So that's a revolutionary theme. And one of the ironies of the film is during the HUAC hearings in 1947, during the Red Scare, when a lot of Hollywood films came under scrutiny for being what they called premature anti-fascist films, which is very Orwellian, you would think The Grapes of Wrath might have been criticized for being radical, but actually Sam Wood, who is a right-wing director who went to HUAC and informed on people, went out of his way to praise The Grapes of Wrath, and he said, well, Hollywood does make some films that are honest and show the flaws in America, and he said in Russia they like The Grapes of Wrath partly because they were impressed that even poor people in America could buy a truck.
Right.
Which is pretty absurd because, you know, it's a miserable thing to have to live, you know, and have all your possessions in a truck. But I think there's something sensible about that in that the family does have adaptability. They can move from one place to another, which we take for granted in America. They have trouble getting across the state line, but they do. But they can start over again, which is part of the American dream and part of the Western myth, you know, is rebirth.
Yes.
And California, as the writer Julia Sloan once said, is the land of the second chance. But it is a kind of a place where things start over and fresh things happen. And as Tom says, there's something going on out there and I want to find out what it is, you know, and that's a hopeful message.
So let's touch on that a bit, too, in terms of a theme and harken back to what you said about Casey, the character, too. There's a lot of biblical allusions and themes in The Grapes of Wrath. You have this journey to the promised land of California, like you talked about. It's almost like the biblical exodus to Canaan. There's a Christ-like figure in Jim Casey who has the same initials as Jesus Christ. A man who must wander in the wilderness as Jesus did, and Casey must sacrifice himself. If you recall the scene under the bridge where he pretty much martyrs himself so that Tom can get away. And now Tom's become enlightened. He's become this apostle of sorts.
Yeah, oh yeah, I think that's very deliberate on Steinbeck's part. He worked in that, and it's often been said the language of the book is biblical. It has a kind of a strong, clear, unadorned prose, but beautiful. And Casey is like a Jesus figure, but he's also kind of like John the Baptist in the way that he kind of leads the way for Tom.
Yeah, I see that too.
And so there are a lot of religious aspects to the film and the martyrdom of Casey. And Ford's heroes are often sacrificial celibates, is what Tag Gallagher called them. And there's a kind of a Christ-like feeling to Tom. And Jesus was an outlaw too. He was killed by the Romans and he was a radical agitator like Tom, you know. So there is that strong sense of religion that Ford brings to the film, being a Catholic director. And,
yeah, right.
Steinbeck actually, even though he was worried about the film, he was really pleased. I found a letter he wrote to his agent after the film was released. He says, Zanuck has more than kept his word. He has a hard, straight picture in which the actors are submerged so completely that it looks and feels like a documentary film, and certainly it has a hard, truthful ring. No punches are pulled. In fact, with descriptive matter removed, it is a harsher thing than the book by far. It seems unbelievable, but it is true.
Wow.
And then in 1958, he told Henry Fonda he had watched a 16mm print of the film that Elia Kazan had stolen from 20th Century Fox. He said, it's a wonderful picture, just as good as it ever was. It doesn't look dated. And a lot of credit should go to Nunnally Johnson, by the way, who wrote the screenplay, which I think in some ways improves on the book. I think the book is wonderful, but Johnson was a fine screenwriter, and he streamlined the book to some extent. There are these interchapters in the book that are, I think, somewhat pretentious, and they slow the narrative down. They're kind of symbolic things, and Johnson took some of those and worked them into the storyline by having the Jodes do some of the things. So it's a kind of a straight line film about a family on a journey, and that's a classic Western or, you know, a classic film trope. And it's about a man realizing his mission and the mother trying to hold the family together. So it has a very strong narrative line. But Steinbeck thought that the photography alone made the film very real, you know, because you read a book and it's great and you believe it, but when you see things,
sure,
and they took a lot of pains. Tom Collins was the technical advisor, and he was the guy who helped run he ran one of those camps and helped Steinbeck a lot in the research. And so they filmed at an actual government camp, and it has that look of reality. And there's some amazing scenes, like when they first go to a squatter camp, there's remarkable sequence, unlike anything in Ford, so I think Toland gets some credit there, that there's a subjective camera shot where the camera is as if it's mounted on the truck, and you're seeing it from the Jodes' point of view, and you see all these kind of lethargic people walking, crisscrossing in front of the camera, looking at the camera, which is something you didn't do in Hollywood back then. And it's so grimy and messy and horrible, and then an old lady gets shot by the police by accident. It's just, you know, very searing material, you know, really, really comes alive.
No question. My final thought here on themes is, of course, the title, The Grapes of Wrath. It's alluding to, of course, the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Yeah, by Julia Ward Howe, Battle Hymn of the Republic. And Steinbeck's wife, Carol, thought of that title. It was called The Oklahomans for a long time, and then she said, call it The Grapes of Wrath, the great title. And it's he's trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. And that's a line from the Bible, so that's another biblical allusion. And Steinbeck liked the title because he said the song is a march and the film is a march.
It hints, Joe, that a time of reckoning is coming. Maybe that the Almighty will merit out justice on the oppressors of the righteous or something, right?
Yeah, that's what the song is about. And it's a Civil War song. It's about, you know, fighting for black rights and citizenship and against slavery. And they played the song when Ford had his funeral in Hollywood. I went to the funeral, and as his body was being taken out of the church, they played the Battle Hymn of the Republic. It meant a lot to him. And his wife used to play that song to wake him up in the morning. He was really hard to wake up because he drank a lot and he would be, you know, really groggy. And she'd play the Battle Hymn of the Republic at top volume and wake him up and throw water on him and stuff. You know?
Well, that'll get you out of bed pretty quick in the morning. Okay, this is a birthday celebration. Birthdays are all about getting presents. I always contend, however, that it's the fans who continue to get the goodies, the gifts. Joe, what is The Grapes of Wrath's greatest gift to viewers?
Well, I say truth and honesty about poverty and the hard life of poor people. You know, like they talk about in America, we're having good economic times. Well, that's not really so if you don't own stocks. If you own stocks, things are going sort of okay, but if you don't, you're working two or three jobs sometimes, you don't have benefits, you don't have a pension, and you know, low-paying jobs. And so there's a lot of poverty in America, and a lot of people just can't find work at all. So this is, you know, this should be a country of wealth and plenty, as The Grapes of Wrath shows. You know, the land is rich, but the people are not treated fairly. So that film deals with the inequities of the economic system in a very harsh way, and the kind of semi-fascistic behavior of the policemen and the goons in those camps toward these ordinary people who are just trying to make a living and feed their families.
You're right.
Gets into the nitty-gritty of what it's like to try to feed your family on a dollar's worth of food, you know. And there's the great scene when Ma Jode sees a lot of starving children in the camp,
yes.
And she shares their food with them, and one of the uncles says, I don't want to eat because all those kids are there. And Tom says, you go and eat and go inside the tent. And he says, it doesn't matter. I can still see them in there, you know. And so scenes like that really stick in your heart. And Ford knew how to wring your heart, as Walter Hill said in the Bogdanovich film directed by John Ford, which I'd recommend. He said he knew how to wring your heart and get you very quickly from comedy to tragedy. And he was like Charles Dickens in that sense. He was a great popular artist. And so is John Steinbeck.
Sure.
So I think that the combination of these two powerful artists working at the top of their powers. Ford was asked in 1936 by an interviewer, Emanuel Eisenberg, for a New Theater magazine. He said, then you do believe as a director in including your point of view in a picture about things that bother you? And Ford said, what the hell else does a man live for?
Well said.
I love that, because that's what motivates Ford, is this anger toward social injustice. And that film just powerfully conveys that. I mean, it's like, you know, films are a time machine, and you feel like you're back there in 1940 with these people, and it's so raw.
That's what I mean. Is there a truer, more honest film about the Great Depression? I don't think so.
No, it really captures the essence of the ordinary person's struggles. And there's a great quote from Woody Guthrie, who I think is one of our greatest artists as well, and he saw the film, and he reviewed it for the Daily Worker, the communist paper, and he sat up all night, he drank a whole bottle of wine, and he wrote a song, Tom Joad, which is terrific, which is kind of just telling the story of the film. And in his review, he wrote, seen the picture last night, Grapes of Wrath, best cussed picture I ever seen. Shows the damn bankers, men that broke us, and the dust that choked us, and comes right out in plain old English and says what to do about it. Go to see Grapes of Wrath, partner. Go to see it and don't miss. You was the star in that picture. Couldn't say it better than myself.
No, well articulated, Joe. You said it. I mean, I think this movie's greatest gift is its social conscience. This is a film made by filmmakers who weren't afraid to stoke the ire of the corporate class, the bankers, the rich landowners, and the right wing. And how did they do it? With the harsh depiction of the treatment of the oppressed, the powerless, the disadvantaged. It's simply just trying to tell the story of one family's struggles against the Great Depression, and in so doing, draw attention to the plight of countless other similar families, right?
It speaks directly to people who are trying to make ends meet and feed their families and working crummy jobs and, working in fields or in kitchens. It arouses your feeling of injustice against corporations and big farmers and the police who are enlisted in their service rather than protecting the ordinary people, which they should be doing. And so it is a, haves and haves not story, and it is seen through the viewpoint of a family, which is a good way to dramatize any kind of story. That's what drama does, is it's not a documentary in the sense of an overview of the situation like Ken Burns does, but it's a saga of one family that we can all relate to. And
absolutely.
So I think it is one of Ford's most directly political films. He often didn't deal with the contemporary world. He dealt a lot with the past. Although when I said that to him, he said, I don't know, I've made a lot of films about the contemporary world, which is true. But this is, one of these films, as they used to say, ripped from the pages of today's headlines. And it has that urgency of 1939, 1940. But we can feel it today because we're having the same issues about, Mexican immigrants coming here to take your jobs.
No question. And my only other thoughts about Greatest Gifts, I think the realistic approach taken by the filmmakers really makes this timeless here. The actors, they look haggard and dirty. The settings appear desolate and destitute. The production design, to me, doesn't look designed at all. It's as if they decided to shoot in real places of squalor and desperation where no hired extras were needed because the bystanders there fit the part naturally. At least it's true in a lot of the camps. And the decision to film this on location in Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona, and California, along Route 66, etc., it just adds to its authenticity. And the stark compositions that Tolan is able to conjure up with minimal lights and true night scene shooting, it all adds up to the dreary tone of the film. But perhaps, Joe, the greatest gift of all, for me anyway, is The Grapes of Wrath's affirmation of the power of a united family. So Ma Jo, she's doing her best to keep her kin together, despite deaths and serious setbacks along the journey. And her abiding faith in her clan, to me, is the glue that keeps the Joads from completely succumbing to external forces and her populist message at the denouement is meant to inspire confidence in the downtrodden everywhere.
Ford was very big on mothers, and a French critic once said, why do you feature mothers in your films so much? And Ford said, you have a mother, don't you? And he had a very strong Irish mother, and he was immigrants. The mother becomes very powerful, and we identify with the family. And it was shot partly on location. Ford had a second unit, actually. Otto Brauer directed the scenes on the highway.
Okay.
They filmed under a dummy title, Highway 66, because of the controversy about the book. So those scenes, which are very well done, and Ford couldn't have done them better himself, and he probably helped plan them, show the progress of the family. But a lot of it was shot around L.A. And in Kern County. They made do with a lot of, kind of local areas that look real. Ford also didn't put any makeup on the actors. That goes with what you said about the actors looking grimy and gritty and real. And there's no glamour in that film. And the settings really are remarkably authentically grubby. And especially that squatter camp is really remarkable. Yeah, and the lighting is just brilliant.
So it's 80 years now for The Grapes of Wrath. Well, what happens another 80 years from now? I assume we're not going to be around, Joe, but let's do some prognosticating here. Does this movie have a future? Who's going to be watching The Grapes of Wrath generations from now?
Well, we have to make sure we preserve it. And when Fox put out the DVD, it turned out that they didn't have a complete negative, and so they had to put together a restored negative based on material at the Museum of Modern Art and other places. And they put together, it looks beautiful on the Blu-ray and the DVD.
But let's assume, Joe, that the materials remain intact. What about an audience? Will this have an audience? And if so, who and where?
Well, I think stories about ordinary people and regular folks are timeless. And, Ford is a great storyteller. People have said he's America's Shakespeare.
I praise.
Richard Nixon wrote a piece for my book on Ford, Searching for John Ford, and he called Ford America's Tolstoy, which I thought was a good comment, too, because Tolstoy encompassed all kinds of human beings within him. He was very complicated politically and socially, but he could relate to every kind of person, and Ford could do that. So we really feel the humanity of this film, as well as the gritty authenticity, and so it transcends time, and it doesn't look phony at all like some older films do, because they tried to be shishi or fashionable,
right,
with their clothing or their settings or whatever, and that dates very quickly. And Oscar Wilde said, "Fashion is something that's so ugly it has to be changed every 6 months," you know. But this film was not fashionable at the time. It was just gritty. And that helps keep it alive. And then you have the great performances that have the ring of human truth to them, especially Henry Fonda. Fonda's amazing.
So, Joe, what are you working on currently that you'd like listeners to know more about?
My book, How Did Lubitsch Do It? My critical study of Ernst Lubitsch is coming out in paperback shortly.
Terrific.
By the time this is aired, it'll be out. Columbia University Press, it's been doing very well. Just won an award in London for Best Silent Film Book of the Year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I'm doing a critical study of Billy Wilder, who is Lubitsch's top acolyte. And he was similar but different. And so it's another big project.
And when can we expect the Wilder book?
Well, I don't want to predict because I'm still working on it. So I'm taking my time and doing it the way I feel it's necessary. The Lubitsch book took 9 years.
Wow.
I did other books in the meantime. I had a book on Frank Capra that came out last year called Frankly Unmasking Frank Capra, which was the story of how I wrote my 1992 biography of Capra with huge legal and financial problems, and I tell that story, which I think is quite riveting.
Right.
You know, I'm at the time of my life where I pick books that are fun to do, and there's nothing more fun than watching Lubitsch films and Billy Wilder films over and over again, as you do when you're writing a book.
Yeah, you can certainly pick a worse profession.
Yeah.
And you also wrote a couple of books on John Ford. Can you mention them briefly?
Yeah, the first one was a critical study called John Ford in the Cinema 2 series from the British Film Institute in 1974 with Michael Wilmington, my co-author, and it was one of the first critical studies of Ford in English, and it's out of print, unfortunately, but I intend to bring it back into print in due course. We study 14 of his films in detail, and a lot of Ford films have become more available since then. But in my biography, Searching for John Ford, which is available through University Press of Mississippi, that came out in 2001, and that's a very large book. You know, I covered everything I wanted to. And it was funny, when I wrote the book, both books were written when Ford was out of fashion. And I kind of thought, oddly enough, when I wrote the biography, nobody's going to read this book, so I might as well just have fun and write whatever I want and indulge myself. And
right, right.
He was a very complicated, enigmatic man, so it makes for a really interesting biography of a great artist who is also kind of a tormented human being.
And you also appeared in that great documentary, Becoming John Ford.
Well, I'm in a number of documentaries on Ford. Yeah, Becoming John Ford is a good one. Nick Redman, the late Nick Redman, did that with Julie Kirgo, a good friend of mine. And beautiful film. It's made for Fox. And it's in the, there's a wonderful DVD set called Ford at Fox, where they released 24
of his
Fox films. It's astounding. He did 52 films for Fox.
Absolutely amazing.
Including The Grapes of Wrath, which I did the audio commentary for.
Yes, absolutely loved it.
And I'm in an Orson Welles film, The Other Side of the Wind, which came out in 2018.
That's right.
And we started shooting in 1970, and it took 48 years to get it out because of all kinds of legal and financial and political problems. And I play a secondary part of a young critic who's following John Huston around. He's this lead of the film. And I'm asking him silly film buff questions. And it's a real ensemble piece. And that's on Netflix, still playing. And there are two documentaries about it, which I'm in. One is called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, which is about the making and the problems that he had trying to finish it. And then the second one, which is harder to find on Netflix, but you can find it by going into, it says trailers and extras. It's called Final Cut for Orson, 40 Years in the Making, which is a fascinating 40-minute film that Frank Marshall did about the post-production, which is really amazing.
Yeah, folks, personally, I can vouch that all of these projects, films, and documentaries are well worth your time. I've seen or read many of them. And Joe, you are to be commended on your work on all these different films and filmmakers, but especially John Ford. I think you have a real passion for him that shows. What is your favorite Ford film, by the way?
Well, thank you. He is my favorite director.
Yeah, right.
I feel I have an affinity with him. I really feel I understand him. That's one reason I wrote the biography. My current favorite, they vary because, you know, he made so many great films. I think They Were Expendable and Wagon Master.
Isn't that the one, Wagon Master, that Ford himself claimed as his personal favorite?
Often he would say The Sun Shines Bright was his favorite. That's a great film, too. Sometimes he'd say Wagon Master, which is a wonderful film. To me, that's sort of the epitome of what a film should be. It's a small, modest film made with a bunch of friends out in the desert.
We will definitely have to check these things out. But Joe, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, and we hope to have you back soon on Cineversary, if you're willing.
Well, thank you, Eric. It's always fun to talk to you, and I really appreciate you asking me to talk about this great film, The Grapes of Wrath. It's a real honor.
Happy birthday, Grapes of Wrath. 80 candles, that's a lot of candles. Kudos again to Joe for his time and expertise, which made for a really fun and fascinating interview. All right, it's time now for Standing Ovations. This is where I give a shout-out to a movie, book, website, TV program, podcast, or other work that I think would be of interest to classic film lovers. So, for January, my standing ovation is a film celebrating a 50th birthday this month. It's MASH, directed by Robert Altman and originally released January 25th, 1970. So, here's the deal on MASH. It's an irreverent comedy that tells the story of a unit of medical personnel stationed at a Mobile Army Surgical Hospital, get it, M-A-S-H, in the midst of the Korean War, although it was more relevant in 1970 for reminding audiences of America's involvement in the controversial Vietnam War. Now, its cast includes Donald Sutherland, Tom Skerritt, Elliot Gould, Sally Kellerman, you've got Robert Duvall, Gary Berghoff, Roger Bowen, and Michael Murphy. MASH has been hailed as one of the funniest films ever, and it was considered groundbreaking at the time because the filmmakers blended in blood and pathos with the comedy, depicting the terrible human price of war. It also inspired the launch of, yes, of course, the hit TV series that ran from 1972 to 1983. Now, fair warning, today MASH can be viewed as sexist and tone-deaf in the Me Too era. But its anti-war message, cross-talking dialogue, episodic structure, and cast of then-young fresh faces still make for a memorable experience. You can find MASH on DVD, Blu-ray, and many streaming services for purchase. That about wraps it up for another episode of Cineversary. If you like what you heard, you can do me a solid. Leave me a positive review on whatever platform you get this podcast from. That's especially true of iTunes and Stitcher. And that helps this show get discovered by new listeners and grows our audience, so much appreciated. Also, instead of cluttering up our show with advertisements, we've decided to ask our listeners for their help. We could use your support to offset the costs to produce Cineversary, which includes expenses like podcast hosting provider fees. If you'd like to make a monetary contribution to the Cineversary podcast in any amount, large or small, we've made it safe and simple by partnering with PayPal to collect the funds. So here's what you do. You simply visit tinyurl.com, that's tinyurl.com/donate Cineversary, and click on the donate button. Any major credit card is accepted, and the entire transaction is handled securely and confidentially by PayPal, so no worries there. We really appreciate your generosity in any form. Want to suggest a future flick due to celebrating an anniversary that we should feature on an upcoming installment? Eager to offer some suggestions or comments? Guess what? You can reach me, Eric Martin, at cineversegroup@gmail.com. I also encourage you to check out cineversegroup.com. Now, that's the portal for my Cineverse film discussion group that I launched 14 years ago and which continues to meet in the South Suburban Chicago area. Cineverse is a democratic film society that watches and then discusses a predetermined movie that our members pick on a rotating basis. At cineversegroup.com, and that's spelled C-I-N-E-V-E-R-S-E, you can hear podcast recordings of our group discussions and read more about the films we study. Okay, you're likely wondering what we slated for February. Well, your wait is over. So here's what we got planned. Next month, we honor a three-digit birthday and a silent film for the first time on this show as we commemorate the 100th anniversary of arguably the first real, true feature-length horror film and that milestone work of German Expressionism, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, directed by Robert Wiene, which was originally released in Germany in 1920. This has been your humble host, Eric Martin, reminding you to butter up that popcorn, live a big screen surround sound life, and of course cherish those classic movies because, hint, hint, they're not really getting older, people. They're just getting better. Thanks again for giving us a listen.